Vogue session number 13718, reel 3.
This is Philip Bristow, reel 2.
All right, I'll go on. When you're ready.
Ready.
Having described the FBA flying boat, and I think we were put on those just to give us a little further experience in a different kind of aircraft. And of course, from my point of view, it was totally different from anything I had ever flown before. A pusher, which was tail heavy, had its own particular characteristics and problems. But as usual, when you got airborne, you found that it seemed to be very much easier once you got the knack of the controls. Certainly, it was a very pleasant thing to fly because, as I say, you were sitting in the front cockpit of a small boat with a huge expanse of sky and sea before you. And we used to go up and down the Solent in these small craft, and I can remember taking off early in the morning because that was a good time when everything was very calm, seeing the sun rise over Portsmouth and the other towns along that shore, and it was indeed a spectacular sight. After qualifying on these small flying boats, we then went on to something bigger on a short 225. This was very similar to the short 184, but had a slightly shorter wingspan and a slightly smaller engine, a 225 12-cylinder V water-cooled engine. Here on this aircraft were proper fixed ailerons for controlling laterally, and the first time I think that I had found this kind of control on a big aircraft. These we were, I think, taken up first under dual control, but just for a short while to get familiar with the controls, and then we were sent off on our own, and we used to fly up and down the Solent and in that area, putting in the requisite number of hours flying before we were finally qualified on that type of aircraft. This didn't take very long, and after that we were put onto the slightly larger version, the short 184. This was a very big aircraft with a wingspan of 64 feet and a 260 horsepower engine driving a very big four-bladed propeller. The revs of this very big engine were about 1,800, and the propeller was geared down half, so there was a propeller speed of 900. A very coarse four-bladed propeller was necessary in order to snatch this kind of aircraft off the water and into the air, because there was a great deal of resistance on the floats. And as I have described earlier, it is necessary to get a fairly considerable forward speed, probably up to 30 knots, to get the floats to rise onto the heels. And at that speed, and increasing speed, of course, because there was very little water resistance, the aircraft very soon got airborne. As far as I remember, with a moderate breeze of, say, up to about 10 knots, and a slight lop on the water, which was very useful because it enabled the floats to release easier than if the water were flat calm, I think we required about 400 to 500 yards to take off. The reason we were able to take off at about 45 knots was because of the very considerable camber on the wings. One must remember that at 64 feet span and a biplane, there was a very considerable lift on the wings themselves. So it could be that the aircraft at about 45 knots would just about get airborne. Having got airborne, one held the machine a few feet above the water to gain speed to about 50 to 55 knots, and at that speed one could climb effectively to quite a considerable altitude. The performance of these aircraft, and most of the flying that I did in them, was at about anything from 800 to 1,000 feet. Although on one occasion, when I was at Westkidd-on-Sea, I thought, when testing one aircraft, that I would see how high I could get in it. And I found that we could get no higher than about 5,000 feet. At that altitude, the machine was almost ready to stall.
Now, this was all at Leon Solent. And does that complete your training phase?
No. I'm going on in a moment. I'm just pausing for breath and trying to get... Having done a certain number of hours on the short 184, I had now qualified as a seaplane pilot. And the next thing was, to complete my training, I had to become familiar with guns and bombs, because the short 184 was armed with a 230-pound and a 100-pound bomb, twin Lewis guns in the rear cockpit for the observer to manipulate, and one Lewis gun on the top plane above my head that I was supposed to manipulate. I could only manipulate that by standing up and pressing the cocking handle. I was then sent over to Calshot from Leon Solent, spending my time in barracks at Wasash and crossing over every morning by picket boat from the Hamble River across to the Calshot Spit, where we spent the day and came back in the evening. Here there were instructors with short 184 seaplanes armed with dummy bombs and with camera guns. We were now given what you would call observer training. That is to say, we sat in the back seat of the cockpit, and there we were taken up and armed with four dummy bombs, 16-pounders. We flew over the marshes where there were stakes laid out forming different group patterns. And here, at certain altitudes, we crossed over and released these bombs, these dummy bombs, watching them descend and seeing how near the target we were. There were obviously ratings down below who would pick these up and bring them back to the station later on. I remember that in order to aim these bombs, we had to be quite sure of the altitude we were at, and this is generally at about 1,000 feet. The pilot would steer the aircraft and fly directly over the target, which, as I say, were these groups of stakes stuck in the marsh below, and I, acting as the observer and bomb aimer, had to wind back a little plywood panel in the floor underneath my feet, where was a bomb sight. This was a device with two bars, parallel bars, which had to be lined up onto the target when the bomb was released. These bars are spaced in such a position that they allowed for the altitude and the forward speed of the aircraft, which one could adjust by turning a knob. In addition to this, there was another sliding bar at an angle to allow for any drift according to the wind direction. So it was a sight, therefore, that took account of the height, the forward speed, and the wind direction. When these were lined up on the target, one pressed a small lever with a, far as I remember, a kind of Bowden wire, and released these dummy bombs underneath the aircraft, one after the other. And it was fascinating looking down through this hole in the floor beneath my feet to see the bomb falling and leaving the aircraft. And it had a very peculiar effect because it seemed to drift behind the aircraft for a while, but one could follow it all the way down. And as it got very near the target, it seemed to shoot forward for the last second or two, and one hoped fall very near the target itself. This we did for a day or two, recording our accuracy or not. And then on another occasion, we were taken up with another seaplane in the sky nearby, and with the camera gun in the observer's cockpit in the back seat, we had to try and focus on this aircraft and get it within the sights, press the trigger, and photograph its position on the spider's web design on the film itself. This we carried out for a short while, and judging by the results which were developed and shown us on the ground afterwards, shown how accurate or not we were. I think that it was very useful for us to have this training, scanty though it was, but it introduced us into the kind of cooperation that there should be between the pilot of the aircraft and the observer, who had to do all the work behind, either in bomb dropping or in firing his guns.
And that was the end of your time at Calshot, was it?
Yes. I'll go on if you like. The time at Calshot, therefore, was comparatively short. I think 2 or 3 weeks at the most. And thereafter, it was deemed that I had had sufficient experience in flying the aircraft and in the maneuvers that they were required to do and how they were to be carried out. Incidentally, during this period, one morning we were told that a small party of us was to go over to Gosport. We were taken over there by car, and here we were taken to the submarine base and put upon and embarked upon a submarine H-26, I think it was, an H-class boat that was going out on manoeuvres that day. So this was a bonus for us, really, to have a trip in a submarine, because our function, I suppose, was to detect German submarines and sink them. But it was deemed that it would be useful to know how a submarine performed also. Anyway, I think on that occasion we were 3 or 4 hours on board this craft, and it spent most of the time dived underwater. We went down the Solent, dived to about 60 feet depth, as I remember, and we were allowed to wander around the very confined space that was there. The crew didn't seem to mind. And whilst we were submerged, they fired a dummy torpedo from one of the forward tubes, and we happened to have aboard a senior naval officer who had come to see this exercise carried out. Apparently, they were using a dummy torpedo with special floats and devices on it so that when it surfaced, they could find it quickly. So, having fired this torpedo, we surfaced and cruised about until we found this dummy torpedo floating with its particular devices that had been invented and were being demonstrated on this occasion. I consider that it was very fortunate that I had this experience, because it was really an introduction to an entirely different branch of the service that we thought was highly dangerous to serve in. But we found out eventually that as flying officers, we had basic pay and what in the Navy was termed hard-lying money, that is extra pay for an extra hazardous duty. And for flying, we had an extra 8 shillings a day, but if we'd served on submarines, we should only have had 4 shillings a day.
What was your basic pay then?
10 shillings a day.
And you had to pay for your own food and everything in the water?
No. We paid a mess bill, but it was only a small subscription. The rest was the booze that we bought in the mess, I'm afraid. Not that we were very heavy drinkers, any of us. We were only lads, only young men, really, but...
It was quite cheap in those days.
It was very cheap in those days, yes. We had it at privileged prices anyway. Mm. Are you recording this?
Yes.
Oh, I see.
I'm interested in the...
As you're recording it, may I go on and say that, that when we were at Van Doom, as I say, everything was treated as a ship, and we were able to get a tobacco ration, as they had in the Navy. This is commonly known as ticklers. I don't know why it is called that, but one had 2 half-pound tins sealed of pipe tobacco every month at a ridiculous low price. At that time, I'd only just learned to smoke and was smoking cigarettes. And because this tobacco was available, I suppose I eventually took to smoking a pipe. But I remember before leaving Van Doom to come back on leave, I had 2 of these tins. And it was the regular drill for people going back home from Van Doom to open the tins and compress the tobacco. Take one tin and compress it into the other. And in order to do this, we made plungers and used the legs of our beds on the plunger and lay on the bed or sat on the bed to press it down. So I took home with me from Van Doom 2 pounds of tobacco, highly compressed, a couple of pounds of butter for my mother, because I couldn't carry any more.
Was the general sort of way you behaved more relaxed in the flying arm than it would have been among the general service sea-going arm, do you think? I mean, did you have uproarious parties and things like that, or were you terribly muted and well-behaved?
At Van Doom, I can't remember how many of us there were in training. Quite a lot at the same time. Could have been as many as 100. There were the instructors, the commanding officer, and other people attached to the station in various capacities, medical and so forth. As far as we were concerned, living in these huts, 24 beds, I think we spent most of our spare time in the huts. We didn't have a riotous time at all, really. I imagine that drink was available if we wanted it, but I don't think any of us were particularly interested. We probably had a glass of beer occasionally, but no more than that. The only time they got drunk was, or we got drunk, if I may put it that way, was when we went on what we would call short shore leave into the town of Van Doom for the afternoon and evening. And I remember on one occasion we went to Van Doom and we would go to this restaurant in the square and have a 6-course dinner, because that was what it was in France in those days. We had a wonderful meal and probably wine to go with it and saunter around the town, but there was nothing to do in the town at all. It was a very quiet little country town with this ancient castle in the middle of it. But some of them, I imagine, drank too much. And I remember on one occasion getting into this 3-ton Leyland truck to come back, and we would be a number of us standing in the back. We had one Canadian who was in... He'd had so much to drink. He was in a state of DTs. We had to hold him down, not only on the floor of the truck, but when we got him back to camp and got him into the hut, because he was crawling around there threatening to knife people.
Mm-hmm. You didn't make the acquaintance of any of the ladies of the town then?
No. No. Very little of that was available anyway, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We were only young boys, you know, really. We were only 18 years of age, most of us. Very inexperienced, I suppose adventurous in a way. And not that we had riotous times, I think we had plenty of fun in one way or another. But life in that air station was very serious, really. We were there to learn to fly. And the Navy, although it had rigorous discipline, it was very relaxed, as I remember, all the time I was at Van Doom. because everything was concentrated on flying, and that the next day would be good weather, and we could fly.
You weren't either also under the psychological stress of operational flying?
Not. No. No.
Because this, I think, leads to much more letting off of steam.
I'm sure it does.
Certainly in the Second War.
Sure it does.
On bomber crews and so on.
Yes, I'm sure. Much greater strain than we had. Flying was in its infancy. It was dangerous anyway, in itself. And one accepted it, and that was life. And you hoped that it wasn't your turn, and a lot of men I knew got injured or killed learning to fly, really.
Did you have many accidents at Leon Soland?
No, we had two, I think. One man was killed in one of these FBA flying boats. I think he fell out. Something happened to the thing, descending. It got out of control. He fell out and hit the water and was killed. It's like falling on a piece of granite, of course, when you descend from a great height. And another one, something went wrong with his engine, and he ended up by landing on top of the cliff, smashing the boat up and smashing himself up quite a lot. I went to see him in hospital, I remember. Visited him once or twice. Other than that, life was very pleasant. It was a very nice place. It was in the early summer. The weather was nice. We were on the sea front there. And we used to go into Portsmouth or Pompey on a short afternoon and evening leave. We'd take a train from Fareham into Portsmouth, wander around there, walk down to Southsea and along the front, try and eye a few girls, I suppose, and then catch the last train back, having had a meal and a drink. I remember coming back to Fareham on the last train about midnight, and I got to Fareham by hiring a bicycle and riding from Leon Solent and parking it in the station. And I remember coming back one night, cycling back, and the narrow lanes, they were all narrow country lanes around there in those days. I suppose nowadays they're dual carriageways. But I can remember coming back through those lanes and seeing thousands of fireflies in the hedges and on the road as I rode down to Fareham. I think on that occasion I was on my own. Any good to say that? Yes.
Your social life?
My social life in Leon Solent and at Calshot was very limited indeed. We were in barracks at Warsash when I served in Calshot, and we were in a private house on the cliff top at Leon Solent. Strangely enough, when we were at Leon Solent, there was a small pier there, and even at that late time in the war, in the summertime, there was a sort of concert party came to Leon Solent and performed at the end of the pier. It was an oldish man and three young women, as I remember, and they carried on the traditional kind of end of the pier show, which was songs and a little bit of slapstick humor and so forth. Very simple and very naive in a way. Obviously, we would go and join in on these occasions and participate almost to the extent of almost getting on the stage and dancing with the leading lady. But this was very childish in a way, but very simple sort of entertainment that went on. I suppose the local inhabitants came and supported it, and we were really on the periphery, really, being at this air station. But we did join in with social events of that kind. And as I say, on short leave, we might go for the afternoon or evening into Portsmouth just for a short while. I completed my training at Leon Solent, was now a qualified seaplane pilot, and was sent on a short leave and then directed to go to Felixstowe. I and one other man, a Canadian, reported at the same time, got to Felixstowe late at night, had to stay the night, so we went to the local hotel, the Felix Hotel, and reported to the commanding officer at the air station. And he said that we were to proceed to Westgate-on-Sea to replace two air crews who had been lost in air combat the week before. So we duly had our passes and railway tickets and so forth, and proceeded to get to Westgate-on-Sea. Well, we had to go via London, and I think we spent the night, if not two nights, in London, going to theatres and enjoying ourselves, and eventually appearing at Westgate-on-Sea and reporting to the commanding officer two or three days later. Here we were received into an active service air station for the first time in our career. And here we realized that life was very serious indeed. They were sending out patrols regularly every day over the southern North Sea with the intention of looking out for enemy action of any kind, particularly U-boat activity or the spotting of drifting mines, because round those shipping lanes both the Germans and the British had laid minefields to protect certain of their areas. These minefields, where mines were tethered at a certain distance below the surface, but not very far below, just to be out of sight, but sufficiently near to be fouled by the passing of any ship's hull that might ride over them, in which case they would be exploded by detonators worked by horns, so-called, on the outside of the mine. In rough weather, it was frequent that these mines would break loose and come to the top, being buoyant, and float on the surface, where they were still a menace and a danger, particularly if they drifted away from the minefield into regularly used shipping lanes, which are then still clearly defined coming out of the Thames, either to go up the east coast or to come round to the Straits of Dover and westward from that exit from the Thames estuary. So our function, therefore, was to look for drifting mines and to look for submarines. Just before we had got there, two of our aircraft had been engaged in combat somewhere near the Kentish Knock light vessel by some seaplanes, fast monoplane seaplanes, which came out from the German-occupied part of Belgium near Zeebrugge, where I think they were stationed on an inland lake, which provided a very good area for alighting and taking off, apart from the rather rough seas that occasionally occurred in the North Sea. Our short seaplanes were very, very well built, very strong, and designed for rough weather, inasmuch as it was possible to take off and land on fairly big waves with a certain degree of bouncing from one wave top to the other until the floats eventually subsided and the aircraft became waterborne instead of airborne. This was a tricky bit of maneuvering because whilst we liked short and small waves, we didn't like them too big. This German seaplane base, near Zeebrugge, had faster aircraft in these monoplane seaplanes, and therefore they had the advantage in flying speed, in maneuvering in any kind of aerial combat that took place. Unfortunately, two of ours had been in combat with them just before we arrived at the station and had been lost with the four members of the two crews that had manned them.